John Douglas and Mark Olshaker have written a book called The Killer Across the Table, Unlocking the Secrets of Serial Killers and Predators with the FBI's Original Mindhunter. John Douglas is a legendary FBI criminal profiler who's interviewed some of America's most notorious killers, including Charles Manson and David Berkowitz. He was also the inspiration for the Netflix series Mindhunter. It's an honor to speak with you today, John.
Oh, thank you.
The Killer Across the Table is about the way violent predators think and includes your insights gained through personal conversations with them. Tell us about the four serial killers you highlighted in this book and what the formula Y plus how equals who means.
Well, let me start with that. Y plus how equals who. When I was at Quantico and when I first got there in 1977, age 32, auditing classes to be, you know, an ex-instructor, being the youngest instructor, the instructors that I was auditing didn't really know the cases that well, didn't really know the motivation behind the offenders because they never did the research. They never went into the penitentiaries to interview, say, the likes of Charles Manson. While they talked about Charles Manson, there'd be students in class from the L.A. area who at times was challenging them regarding the information that they were presenting was erroneous. And I'm sitting back there thinking, geez, I cannot be a good instructor, particularly if I have to parrot what these guys are saying here because their information is wrong. So to understand, let's go interview the guys in prison. We know who it is now because we've caught them, but let's see the whys of the behavior. You know, why this particular crime? Why this victim? What was their pre-offense behavior that precipitated the crime, their post-offense behavior? And so start interviewing a whole array of different types of violent offenders. Take it back to Quantico, and then little did I know, I was just doing this to survive as an instructor, that the program would begin to grow as cops came back to attend classes through the FBI National Academy or FBI agents classes, that they would now bring cases with them. So what first year received 59 cases, and then it just kept doubling. So when I left the Bureau in 95, when I retired, we were doing 1,000 cases a year. Why I picked these four particular cases, because they're different. I've done this is like the 15th book. I did two academic books, then I did these trade type of books, true crime books, but they're all so different. You have a guy by the name of Joseph Condro in the state of Washington, real unusual. He picked his friend's children, you know, as victims who he would rape and kill. And so I go through that with the whys of his behavior and, you know, why he did that. I'd never had a case, you know, like him. Then I go up to New Jersey, Joseph McGowan. He is a school teacher with a master's degree, and he will select a brownie who comes to his door to collect money for the sale of a box of cookies to this guy's mother. And he goes through the details of what he did, how he did it, the motivation. And I did an interview with him. I represented the parole board. They wanted to see what I could come up with because he was going to get out of prison after serving the maximum sentence. So I go through the whole interview process, which at the time was really fascinating to watch him and how I set up the interview room a particular way, low lighting, and brought him back 30 years earlier. And at the end of the interview, I'm sure he realized, well, why did I just tell this guy this stuff? Because the next day I went before the parole board and they were shocked how I got this information. So I have him. And then I go down to South Carolina, real unusual case, Todd Kohlhepp. Your listeners may remember about 2 years ago, the Spartanburg Police Department rescued a woman in a storage container down there who had been in this container in and out though, by the subject, Todd Kohlhepp, for a couple of months. And he's probably one of the smarter serial killers. And I got involved. He killed four people in a motorcycle shop, and then he went on to kill three more people. I got to work with the police. I did an analysis, but then I really got to get information out of him that was fascinating. And he wanted me to tell him why he did the things that he did. So I kind of laid it out for him and there. And then, of course, you go back to your state in Cincinnati, and it's Donald Harvey, who I was involved when he got caught poisoning people. The FBI was involved in the investigation. It was the VA hospital. And I got involved in coaching the agents on how to interview him. And then a major network followed me into the prison, and I did an interview, you know, with him. And he is good for, no one really knows the number. It can be 87, I say. It could be 100. There's no way of knowing because there were no autopsies done with many of the people that he killed. Because he's killing elderly. If the elderly person dies in a hospital, they just write it off to whatever it is that got that person in that hospital. So they don't do autopsies. Those are the four that I go through in this particular book.
Well, I'd like to focus, of course, on Donald Harvey, since he was here doing some of his murders here in Cincinnati at the VA hospital. And he was born in Butler County, right up the road in 1952. And it seems like his killing began when his mother asked him to visit his grandfather in Marymount Hospital down in London, Kentucky.
Right. Yeah, and at 18 years of age. And one thing about him, he was a good student in school. Everyone liked him. And when he went to visit his grandfather and was visiting the hospital, the staff there really liked having him around and ended up offering him a job. They could have done some due diligence on him. That's the problem with some of these cases. And with these kind of workers, they're so hard to get because they're going to be doing dirty work in these hospitals and the nursing homes, because they would have found out that, he had problems. He tried to join the service. He attempted suicide, a couple of times. He got out under a general discharge, but he was just a very, very depressed type. Then became fascinated by death, really kind of was triggered when he was visiting his grandfather. And then that's where his grandfather passes away, and they offer him a job, and that's when it really began. And he's known, or he calls himself the Angel of Death, but he's no Angel of Death. There are different types of killers who kill, of the ones I've studied in hospitals. There's one that we call the mercy killing, which he's trying to claim Harvey that he is. There's also the hero type, who will overdose a victim and try to save the day. Like, they're the first ones at the scene to rescue the patient. And more times than not, they fail. And then there's another type. It just happened, really. You don't see many of these. But in Texas, they arrested a Kenyan who was from Kenya, illegally living in this country. And he would go to different nursing homes, and he had a little bit of medical background, but serving as an orderly. And he killed 11 or 12 patients, and then after killing them, he would rob them. They are now looking at 750 deaths that were on his watch, not saying that he did them all, but they're going to investigate just to see if there's any kind of linkage or maybe get him to confess to more cases. But once again, it's really difficult unless you're looking for something. And what would get Harvey caught was a patient comes in. He was involved in a motorcycle accident. Harvey made his mistake. He tells me during the interview, I said, if you could do it again, Donald, what would you do differently? He says, well, I wouldn't have killed the guy on the motorcycle because that's how they caught me. Because what the ruling in the state is, if someone dies from an accident, they have to perform an autopsy. And then the medical examiner was just a very, very experienced doctor and experienced being around cyanide. And when he opened up the body, began the autopsy, he got the smell of burnt almonds, and he knew right away that this person here was poisoned, and that was the downfall of Harvey.
And besides working in the hospital, he also had a relationship with an undertaker where he learned new techniques.
Right. He had a sexual relationship with the undertaker, and the undertaker, in turn, would teach him ways of killing, and like, for example, he would tell him, don't put any, like a pillow over a victim's face and try to suffocate them because they'll inhale some of the fibers. So what you do, he told them to put a plastic case between the pillowcase and the patient's face. And they taught him other things. Plus, he's trying to tell me he's the Angel of Death. But I say, Angel of Death? I said, what about this one patient? He's one of your earlier patients here. And he threw feces, on you. And you went back and he had a catheter. And you put an extra large catheter in him, which is meant for a woman, not a male. And then you got a coat hanger. And then you ran the coat hanger through the catheter and punctured his abdomen, and he would die of peritonitis. I said, what about that one? And he said, well, yeah, that's different. And I said, what about your neighbor? Your neighbor who really didn't like you, that much, but somewhat of a friendly relationship, but you ended up poisoning her. You poisoned an apple pie, and you killed her. Well, yeah. And then I said, what about your lover, your boyfriend you were living at? You got jealous when he was running around behind your back, so you decided to give him some poison, but just enough to make him sick so that he wouldn't go down to the park and play around with other guys. And I said, oh, well, yeah. In fact, when I was doing the interview later on, this network, they didn't like the way I was doing the interviews. They thought I should be in the guy's face and you know, like waving my finger at them. And you don't do interviews like that. I don't. You're on a fact-finding mission. You're trying to learn, you know, in this case. And so when he's telling me this, he says, well, yeah. So I would just smile along, you know, with him. He says, who are you kidding? I mean, you're not exactly the angel, you know, of death here. But the producers and the top people at this network, they thought I should be like that with him and some other ones I interviewed. And that's not the way. Even with some of the worst killers, I'd never do that. I see other people on television doing this, like celebrity types. There's one particular person who really challenges them, and, you know, they call him a liar, you lie. No, you don't do that. If you're trying to get information, there's a whole modus operandi that I go through when I go in there. In fact, from the Netflix series Mindhunter, season one was like a year and a half ago. I'm getting ready for season two. Hopefully it'll be this summer sometime. But they show, even in the opening, they show this tape recorder. And then when the actors who are portraying me and my partner, they bring this tape recorder in for the interview and in all the interviews. And I only did it once. Interviewed Kemper, had a small cassette recorder. But that was it. No more. Because these people, they're paranoid to begin with. They're living in a paranoid environment. They don't trust anybody. All these inmates, a lot of violent inmates. Word gets out in the joint that someone like me is coming in. They know it before anyone knows it, that I'm going to be coming. And if I'm going to be speaking to a specific person, that person's potentially in danger. If they believe that, you know, he may be providing information like a snitch. You know, so people were asking me after I had these calls from producers all over the world, wanted to do a show with these tapes, all these tapes, and I had to tell them there are no tapes. There's no tapes at all. When I go in the interview, and some of the times the inmates have remarked that they realize I don't have any notes, I study the crime beforehand very, very thoroughly. And when I go in, I don't bring anything with me. There is no tape recorder. I don't want to be taking notes and losing eye contact with them. I'm in there not to interrogate, not to do an interview. I'm there to have a conversation. In fact, they'll be asking me as many questions about me as I will with them. And I want them to kind of relax and then kind of maybe morph into, get or mesmerize into this conversation where they'll start talking and tell me things that maybe later on they'll regret they ever talked to me or said the things that they did. That's pretty much how I go about doing it.
How many interviews did you do with Donald Harvey and where?
Harvey, I did right in the prison. The initial, when he was arrested, that was done in an FBI office. But the other interview was in the prison where he was murdered a year and a half ago. That's where where I did that interview.
And speaking of him being murdered, I'm wondering, why is it that the prison officials put him into a room with James Elliott?
My understanding was that both of them were like in protective custody. Not only that, which is kind of surprising, it just came out recently that he was charged. That happened, you know, over a year ago. And that's why when I see cases like this, I could see if people are against the death penalty, well, it's fine. But for the people that work in that environment, or if a guy goes in there and he's a murderer, he murdered a bunch of people, knowing that he can't get the death penalty, who's to say he won't kill some more? Why? What are you going to do to me? Give me another life sentence? What if I want to kill a correctional officer? So what? What are you going to do to me? So there should be something for the protection, particularly protection of the people that work there. You know, people ask me, were you scared during the interviews, like with Kemper? You know, he's so big, 6'9", 300 pounds. He killed, you know, so many people and viciously. And really, no, not so much now the interview. It's the environment. It's just a very dangerous environment. It's just noisy. It's loud. And you can't trust anybody. You just don't know who to trust. I mean, is a correctional officer maybe working in this environment? Is he really close-knit with the inmates? Because probably a good percentage of them are, if only for the reason of survival. Because if something happens within that system, there's a riot, they don't want to be the bad guy. Because that's the first guys that they grab are the guys that cause the most trouble to the inmates. So when I interviewed like Richard Speck, killed seven nurses in Chicago, I mean, he was in a cage waiting for me, and he was like a wild animal waiting in this cage with a desk in there and chairs, but they wanted me to see his jail cell and the pornography in his jail cell. And as we were walking to the cell, and inmates are chanting, if you get too close, they'll throw urine on you. There were broken glass. It's like four-tier prison, this wing I was in, broken glass, birds flying, you know, in and out, and just real, real intimidating environment. And then when I got back And that day I told the, it was his counselor who was showing me his cell. I said, hey, look, forget it. Let's just forget about that. Let's just walk back and go where Spec is. And I go where Spec is, screaming, yelling, and all around. It's just very, very loud. And I just decide I'm just going to turn my back to him. I'm going to make believe he's not even here. And I'm going to have a conversation with his counselor. And Spec, he's throwing F-bombs at me the whole time. But I just totally ignore him. I start talking to his counselor about the crimes that Spec perpetrated. He used street terms, street language, to talk about what he did to the victims, and said something to the effect to his counselor, I don't know what Richard eats for breakfast, but I don't know how he was able to have sex with these seven nurses. And I know he didn't do it. And then all of a sudden, he chimes in the back, and using the street language, saying that he didn't do them all. And I said, I know, it was just the one on the couch. I turn around now, and he's sitting on top of a credenza, because most of the time, and I give them that opportunity, I don't tell them to do it, but a lot of times they'll do it because they want to dominate. They want to dominate me. It's just like they dominated their victims, like Harvey. It was power and control over the victims who he killed in the hospitals in Ohio. And you let them do that. You let them have this sense of control and domination. Charles Manson did it to me. I'm 6'2". He's 5'2". I knew he was going to do it because when he was at the George Spahn Ranch with his Manson followers, that was his thing, was to sit up on top of a rock and then talk and chant or play his guitar to his flock there. So you let them do it because the crimes, it's manipulation, domination, and control. And how can these inadequate nobody, like a Donald Harvey, how could this inadequate nobody have some kind of power? He doesn't want people to find out what he's doing, but it's a sense that he has this, that he can play God and be in control over others. And that's why this, going back to him, this business about mercy, yeah, he had some very, very sick people. There was one woman who wishes she was dead, she told Harvey. And he accommodated her. He killed her. But the other, some of the other ones, you know, it was just a lot of it was retaliation because these people are sick and they're out of it. They're on different prescription drugs and they may fight. It's a difficult job. And because it's such a difficult job, someone like Harvey was bouncing around to different hospitals to get rid of him, just to get rid of him, let him go to a different hospital. It may be suspicious, but no one's pointing the finger at him that he's killing. There's a guy in Germany who was a nurse. They're looking at 300 patients that he killed. And you see, it's different than a Ted Bundy. A Bundy is like, for example, is a predatory type of killer. Harvey doesn't have to be predatory. Harvey has his victims are right there. The victims come to him. They're right there for, you know, easy pickings. And it makes it really, really, really easy for someone so inclined, you know, to kill, who wants to kill and pick on and target, you know, the weak and the elderly, the sick. And that's what Harvey did, and this guy in Germany, and the guy I mentioned a while ago down in Texas as well.
After your conversations with him, do you think he was insane or knew what was right or wrong?
Oh, yeah. I've only had one or two that really were out of it. But he knew right from wrong, the nature and consequences of his actions. I asked him a question, a nurture type of thing. And he said, no, he doesn't believe, you know, someone is, and neither do I, born bad, born to kill. There's no killing gene. Again, you see, early on in his life, he'd be sexually assaulted by an uncle. He'll be sexually assaulted by a neighbor. And it was just kind of a downhill, you know, spiral. They come across really, and he did, you know, very, very confident, almost charming. But behind that superficial shell, there's this really inadequate nobody type of existence. Even when I was in prison, he doesn't come across that way, but that's exactly how he was. And I asked him, how do you escape? I asked him a question about, what do you think about? I thought he was going to tell me, like at nighttime, because a lot of the guys I speak with, they fantasize and relive the crimes. They enjoy thinking about them while they're in prison. He starts getting real jovial and starts saying, well, I'm building a house, and it's got 3 bedrooms. It's going to have 3 baths, you know, and I'm working now on an additional room. And, you know, like that was his way of escaping. So he was a little different, you know, as well.
Well, thanks for sharing your thoughts about serial killers, especially Donald Harvey, John. And this was a great book.
Well, thank you very much. It's different, and it really takes a look at the interview, that whole interview, the process of how, you know, I've done it. I made mistakes in the beginning. And one of the things, too, is I don't rely on self-reporting. And that's a problem with many of our institutions today. when they're dealing with a Donald Harvey's or anyone else incarcerated, they don't look at the crime, the autopsy photographs, the police reports. I look at everything. Why? Because if I don't, they're going to test me during this conversation I'm going to have with them to see if I really know their case. And if they realize I don't know the case, they're going to lie to me. You know, it's a given. The psychologists, psychiatrists, people in corrections, some may, but a lot of them do not. And their reasoning is it would prejudice them in their treatment or their recommendations whether or not this person should be paroled. And then I go back to them. They don't like it when I tell them, well, you have no business being in a position to make these kind of recommendations, probation, parole, or sentencing, or treatment, because you don't really fully understand the criminal personality. These people lie to you. So forget about self-reporting. Study the crime, I tell them. But thanks again so much for having me.
Oh, yeah. Thanks to you for taking the time. I could talk for
a Just keep the lights on, doors locked.
Really?
Thanks for having me.
I've been in conversation with John Douglas, co-author, along with Mark Olshaker of the book The Killer Across the Table, Unlocking the Secrets of Serial Killers and Predators with the FBI's Original Mindhunter. You'll find a link at wvxu.org/AroundCincinnati. I'm Lee Hay.